BBC Radio 3 it is, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock. Time for the news from Vaughan Savage.
The Chancellor, George Osborne, has been forced to reject accusations that his economic policy is failing after the UK was stripped of its AAA credit rating. The ratings agency Moody's has downgraded Britain's status to AA1 because of concerns about the country's sluggish recovery. Labour called it a humiliating blow. But Mr. Osborne insisted the government was delivering on its commitment to tackle the debt problem. The Liberal Democrat President, Tim Farron, has promised a thorough investigation into claims that the party's former chief executive behaved inappropriately towards women. Lord Rennard has strenuously denied the allegations. The party has also disputed a suggestion that one party activist was sacked and forced to sign a gagging order. The UK Independence Party MEP Marta Andreasen has confirmed she is defecting to the Conservatives. 2 weeks ago, she accused UKIP's leader, Nigel Farage, of being anti-women and a Stalinist, and said he treated any views other than his own with contempt. In a statement, Mr. Farage said, "The woman is impossible." The Vatican has reacted angrily to reports in the Italian media of intrigue, blackmail and corruption at the highest administrative level of the Roman Catholic Church as the Pope prepares to step down. A Vatican spokesman complained that attempts were being made to sow confusion and to discredit the Church by gossip, disinformation and slander. The King of Spain's son-in-law has appeared before a judge on the island of Mallorca to answer questions about tax fraud. The Duke of Parma and a former business partner are accused of siphoning funds from a charitable organisation to companies and bank accounts under his control. He denies wrongdoing. England's cricketers have won the deciding one-day international against New Zealand by 5 wickets to take the series 2-1. England reached their target of 186 with over 12 overs to spare. The weather, it will be an overcast afternoon with some snow flurries. North-east England and parts of East Anglia will see heavier snowfall. Overnight temperatures will fall to around -2. The BBC News and Weather at 1:02 past 1.
And time for the Early Music Show, presented by Catherine Bott.
Hello. When is versatility more of a curse than a blessing? When you're a musician, I reckon. People tend to want, need you to be good at just one thing and stick to it. Makes life easier. I've often wondered if wide-ranging ability has been Georg Philipp Telemann's problem. Not in his lifetime, of course. He was a star, a huge success, the man the elders of Leipzig preferred to J.S. Bach. But I know that there are many discerning Early Music Show listeners who believe that his mastery of so many styles and idioms should be proclaimed more loudly. Well, in today's programme, I'm going to do my bit for Telemann the Everyman, the composer who excelled in all directions and purposely made his music appealing and available to the widest possible audience. To shed light on the subject and the music we'll hear, we spoke to Stephen Zohn, Professor of Music History at Temple University in Philadelphia, USA. He began by explaining how innovative it was for Telemann to go into what might seem to be a very 21st century business.
Self-publishing music in Germany at the time was unusual, but a number of composers did it, mainly because there was really an undeveloped industry for publishing music, and that partly has to do with the devastation of the 30 Years' War in the 17th century, but also because there were no central publishing centers such as London and Paris or Amsterdam, where you had publishers devoted to publishing music. That really wasn't the case in Germany. And by the time Telemann got to Hamburg in 1721, I think he realized that his ambitions as a musician who wanted to publish his music and get it out there were not going to be realized if he had to rely on others. So he came up with a plan to publish his own music. Telemann set up a distribution network of booksellers and musicians across Europe so that one could get his publications relatively easily. Now, the first piece is an excerpt from one of Telemann's largest published collections, the Fortsetzung des harmonischen Gottesdienstes. Here, we hear a cantata for the second Sunday after Epiphany. And like all of the cantatas in the collection, this one has two arias framing a short recitative. And the arias express a passage from the Gospel of John, next, a woeful sound, a sobbing alas, must ring the knell of my pleasure. With much grief and bitter pain, my separation through death plagues my heart, my tears flow in torrents. There's some reason to believe that these are arrangements for more fully scored cantatas, so that people could perform them more easily in their homes, or churches out in the countryside who didn't have lots of musicians could perform these pieces.
jedoch mein Blick soll etwas weiter gehen. Das Auge dieser Welt will nur was gegenwärtig sehen. Er ist ein irdischer Verdruss, ein tränenwerter Schaden. Ich aber lasse, wenn der Glückesbau zerfällt, des Glaubens Augen offen stehen. Denn weh verwandelt deine Macht und Gnade, Immanuel, den Mangel nicht in Überfluss, das lautere Wasser nicht in edlen Wein, folgt auf den Regen nicht ein holder Sonnenschein.
Oh,
A devotional cantata by Telemann, performed by soprano Ruth Zizak and members of Kammerata Köln. One of the secrets of getting your music to reach as wide a public as possible is to make it adaptable for different numbers of players, as Telemann did with those cantatas. Another is to offer people as wide a variety of music as you can. A taste of the exotic always appeals, and Telemann was an absolute natural when it came to absorbing and recycling the most attractive elements of different national styles. Our next music combines these two skills. It's a fantasia in the French style for solo flute. Cosmopolitan sounds, no need for an accompanist. Here's music historian and baroque flautist Stephen Zone.
The idea of publishing music for unaccompanied flute was relatively unusual, and what Telemann asks the flutist to do here is even more unusual. In this particular fantasia, number 7 in D major, transposed to F major for recorder, the piece opens with a French overture, which is of course a kind of orchestral music, usually in two parts with a slow, majestic section with dotted rhythms, followed by a fast imitative section. And so the flutist here has to imitate an orchestra, which is quite a feat, especially in the fast section where the flute has to sort of imitate itself in a fugal texture. And this is followed then by a short dance that stands in for the suite that might follow a French overture in a fully scored work.
Stephen Zone. Something for everyone now as we hear Telemann's Fantasia No. 7 played on the recorder by Marion Verbruggen. Marion Verbruggen, more than meeting the challenge of playing an unaccompanied melody instrument in the style of a French overture, in that Fantasia by Telemann. Next, an aria from a very unusual work, Telemann's St. John Passion. Stephen's Own.
This next selection, I think, presents a side of Telemann that is perhaps not as familiar as what we've heard so far. This is an aria from the 1745 St. John Passion. Every year, Telemann had to write a Passion Oratorio, and we have about half of his Passion Oratorios that survive. Now, this one, unlike the others, was published. Publishing an entire Passion was almost unheard of at the time, and speaks to not only the popularity of Telemann's music, but his willingness to undertake such a large project. So this is a reflective aria following a recitative in which Jesus, in response to his betrayal by Judas, says, "Shall I not drink the cup that my Father has given to me?" So this is newly written reflective poetry and then set by Telemann. And the style here is very much in the mid-century idiom that we might know better from C.P.E. Bach and Karl Heinrich Graun. So here Telemann is showing how aware of and receptive he is to the idiom of the next generation of composers.
Thank you.
The aria Soll mir zu bitter dünken from Telemann's St. John Passion. Patrick Pehrer directed the Collegium Instrumentale Bruchense with soprano soloist Catherine Bott. Putting my broadcasting hat very firmly back on, you're listening to the Early Music Show, and in today's edition I'm looking at Telemann's gift for making his music accessible, which in his day was not a piece of lazy cultural jargon, but a very good thing. Telemann had a special gift for combining familiar musical idioms with cutting-edge ideas. Stephen Zone has already mentioned Graun, 20 years younger than Telemann, and perfectly content to plough a fairly straight furrow through Italian opera, mainly to please his royal patron Frederick the Great. Graun and Telemann occasionally competed in their writing, each bringing their own sensibilities to the same texts.
Now we come to a brief chorus from Telemann's oratorio Der Tod Jesu, The Death of Jesus. This is the first in a series of late oratorios Telemann wrote in more or less his last decade. These late oratorios were inspired, I think, by the poetry of the younger generation. Now, Telemann wrote this piece in sort of a friendly competition with his colleague at the Berlin court, Karl Heinrich Graun, who also set this libretto by Karl Wilhelm Rahmler. Now, this chorus, "Our soul is bowed down to the earth, O woe that we have sinned so," is sort of a mixture of the old church style flavor of late Renaissance polyphony known in Telemann's day as the stile antico, the antique style, mixed with more modern chromatic harmony that we would associate again with someone like C.P.E. Bach and, of course, Graun himself. So it's an interesting mixture and highly expressive, and it brings to mind one of Telemann's favorite sayings, that if nothing new is to be found in melody, then search for it in harmony.
A grieving chorus from Telemann's Der Tod Jesu, performed in Berlin and Hamburg in 1755, and on that recording by Ex Tempore with Le Mercure Galant, directed by Florian Heyrich. Now, from plangent choral writing to some essentially soloistic music.
So now we turn to another instrumental work, And this is the second concerto from the Quadri, which is a publication of quartets, essentially trio sonatas with an added melody instrument. Quartets were relatively unusual in Telemann's day. They were considered difficult, especially difficult to compose, because you were keeping four independent contrapuntal voices going at once. Telemann really was the master of this genre. We don't have such pieces by J.S. Bach or Handel, and it really was sort of a German specialty on the whole. And in this publication, Telemann gives us six works, two he calls concertos, two he calls sonatas, and two he calls balletti, which are essentially suites. This particular work is called a concerto because the outer movements imitate the style and the structure of more conventionally scored concertos. Now, here we have flute, violin, viola da gamba, and continuo. And so every instrument takes a turn being a soloist and being a member of the orchestra. So we have the familiar kind of ritornello structures in the outer movements. And interestingly, in the middle movement, we have essentially a duet where the flute and violin are the vocal soloists and the viola da gamba with continuo provides the orchestral accompaniment.
Professor Stephen Zone of Temple University, Philadelphia. Before we hear the sprightly playing of flautist Wilbert Hatzelset, I can't pass up the chance to quote that 18th century authority on all things flutish, Johann Joachim Quantz. In 1752, he wrote, "A quartet is the true touchstone of a genuine contrapuntist and is often the downfall of those who are not solidly grounded in their technique. A certain group of quartets which Mr. Telemann wrote some time ago may provide excellent and beautiful models for composition of this type."
Thank you.
Flautist Wilbert Hatzelset with Trio Sonneri in that Concerto Secondo from Telemann's Quadri. Now that strikes me as quite demanding music, full of light and air and charm, but actually needing a highly attuned sense of ensemble to bring off. But Telemann knew his audience, as Stephen Zone explains.
What I think ties all of these musical examples together is a sense that Telemann is trying to provide something for everyone, and often he manages to do that in a single work or a single publication. Some of his publications are expressly aimed at amateurs. Others seem more aimed at professionals in terms of what they require technically and conceptually, but almost none of them talk down to less accomplished musicians. He was always trying to educate and edify at the same time. So you find that some of the simplest pieces actually present problems for the listener or the performer. Not so much technical, since he was trying to avoid extreme technical difficulties, but more conceptual, that one had to come to terms with a different style, a national style, the English, the Polish, the German, the French, the Italian. Or one had to piece together why a viola da gamba is being asked to sing recitative, for example. These are all challenges that I think his contemporaries found extremely interesting and compelling. Now, this last piece is the opening chorus to another one of these late oratorios called Die Donna Oder. So the music of this chorus is more on the lines of what we often hear in Handel's choruses. There's a move away from kind of a contrapuntal treatment, which is starting to be considered old-fashioned, and into something that's a little more chordal and speech-oriented. This was an extremely popular piece, this chorus, and Telemann repeated it at the end of the piece as well.
Professor Stephen Zone, and my thanks to him for so eloquently sharing his expertise. Let's finish with that suitably laudatory chorus from Telemann's Thunder Ode, with Hermann Max directing the Rheinische Kantorei and Das kleine Konzert. Wie ist dein Name so groß? How great is thy name?
Thank you.
How Great Is Thy Name, a chorus from Telemann's Thunder Ode. The Rheinische Kantorei and Das Kleine Konzert were directed by Hermann Max. The Early Music Show was presented by Catherine Bott and produced by Alwyn Fisher. And in tomorrow's programme at 1 o'clock, Lucy Skeeping will be exploring the Marian hymn Salve Regina.
Our Britain 100 celebrations on BBC Radio 3 continue with an opera the composer wrote for television, a pacifist response to militarism in general and the Vietnam War in particular.
I can't go through with it.
What's that?
I can't go through with it. Can't go through with it.
You can't.
Owen Wingrave is this week's opera matinee in Afternoon on 3. Thursday afternoon from 2 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
Well, we've just said goodbye to Catherine Bott, but here she is again, in voice anyway, if not actually in person, introducing a concert which was first broadcast last Monday.
Welcome to Wigmore Hall for today's live lunchtime recital and a slight change of plan. Sadly, Andreas Häfliger is indisposed. In his stead, another pianist whom it's always a great pleasure to welcome to Wigmore Hall and to the airwaves, Thlea Williams. And we're very grateful to Thlea for stepping into the breach and fitting us into his busy schedule. He's going to transport us into the phantasmagorial light of the moon in his recital, with impressionistic sonatas by Beethoven and Scriabin that are fantasy-like in character, and Brahms's set of seven fantasies, Opus 116, which are actually divided into quickfire caprices and more stately intermezzos. So nothing is as it might seem under the moon's silver gaze. I expect you're ahead of me by now, after my mention of moonlight and Beethoven, and indeed, Thlea Williams is shortly going to begin with Beethoven's sonata in C-sharp minor, Opus 27, number 2, but much more familiarly known as the Moonlight Sonata. That name wasn't Beethoven's idea. Almost 20 years after it was published, a friend of his likened the sonata's opening slow movement to a boat visiting by moonlight the primitive landscapes of Lake Lucerne. And the name stuck. What's far more interesting about the sonata is Beethoven's daring. By starting so slowly and quietly with that haunting moonlit scene, he's bending all the rules of the piano sonata as it stood at the beginning of the 19th century. And he did ask for the movement to be played very delicately without dampers. In other words, with a sort of shimmer. It's an extraordinary effect. No wonder Beethoven called the work a sonata in the manner of a fantasia. Now, to begin his recital with Beethoven's Sonata No. 14 in C-sharp minor, we welcome very warmly Thlea Williams.